In October 1983, the Nottinghamshire suburb of Keyworth was rocked by the sudden disappearance of 16-year-old Colette Areham.
I just knew Colette so well. She was so predictable. I knew something was wrong. And I knew that I had to phone the police.
As a massive police investigation was launched, detectives became aware they were dealing with a predator intent on committing a vile and vicious attack.
This crime understandably ripped Colette's family apart, and Keyworth itself has never been the same since.
But this was a crime destined to taunt detectives and Colette's family for a quarter of a century.
He would have seen the publicity about this case over the many years and just remained his cool, calm individual that the family thought he was.
I feel like I've been punished. He was getting on with his life as far as I could see, whereas he destroyed ours, he destroyed my family, he destroyed my marriage.
But Nottinghamshire police remained determined to catch Colette's killer, however long it took. The sleepy suburb of Keyworth lies to the southeast of the city of Nottingham.
Keyworth's a very nice village. There is very good community spirit there. I would say it's quite an affluent area.
In the early 1980s, Keyworth was home to the Areham family, parents Jackie and Tony, and their two teenage children, Mark and Colette.
The Areham's are a lovely family. Really nice people to know. Love the kids to bits.
And their youngest child, 16-year-old Colette, was the perfect daughter.
She was vivacious, bubbly, a bit giddy at times. She could never see any bad in anyone, and she cared about other people too.
She was a loyal best friend.
Colette was a lovable person, great to get on with. Everybody liked Colette. She was one of these people you could trust.
The 16-year-old was enjoying a new, more independent lifestyle, having recently left school and started an apprenticeship as a hairdresser.
I think she would have been very good in the hairdressing profession. She was quite an arty person, and she was very interested in the beauty side too.
She also liked spending time with her boyfriend.
They'd been seeing each other 6 months, and they were a nice, loving couple, suited to each other.
At just 16, Colette had her whole life ahead of her.
If Colette was here now, I would like to think that she was still this happy, go-lucky, love life, love people person that she was all those years ago.
But in 1983, the Areham family was to experience the most devastating series of events. The 30th of October was just like any other day.
Colette wanted to make cakes. We had our tea together and had some of the cake. And then she went and got herself ready to go out to her boyfriend's.
Colette's boyfriend would usually pick her up in his car. However, on this one particular night, he didn't have the use of any transport.
She came in and said that his car was off the road, and she said it was a nice night and she wanted to walk.
But Jackie wasn't happy with the arrangement.
I said, no, you know, I'm going to take you in the car. And she said, no, Mum, I don't want you to. It's a nice night. I want to walk.
Are you sure?
Jackie refused to back down, but Colette was determined to walk.
Fine, honestly.
Eventually, I said to her, OK, you know, if you're insistent, just be very careful and you make sure that you're home for about 9:30. And she said, OK, Mum, we'll do.
Bye-bye.
Colette left her home at around 7:50 p.m. on Sunday, the 30th of October, 1983.
She put her arms around me and said, love you very much, and I'll see you later. That was it, and she left the house. That was the very last time I saw her.
The walk from Colette's house to her boyfriend's would normally take around 20 minutes. Just after she left, Colette's boyfriend telephoned the house.
He just asked if she was at home, and I said no. She said to tell you that she'd walked up Nicker Hill to your house. And he said, OK, then I'll go on my bike and I'll meet her.
Several minutes later, the telephone rang again.
He phoned back and said, I thought you said Colette was walking up Nicker Hill, but I've been all the way around the village on my bike and I can't see her anywhere. When he said that, the alarm bells went and I just knew something was wrong.
She's not there.
I knew my daughter, I knew her so well. And I knew that if she'd gone anywhere or called in at anyone's house on the way, she would have made sure that she'd have phoned me.
But Colette hadn't called, and Jackie started to panic.
I was thinking that maybe a car or something had hit her and that she was lying in a hedge bottom, she'd been knocked over. And I can remember, I think it was my neighbour who said to me, look, Jackie, you know, this is Keyworth. You know, stop worrying, nothing like this ever happens. And I said, it might be Keyworth, but there's a first time for everything, and I'm telling you, something has happened to my daughter.
On Sunday, the 30th of October, 1983, 16-year-old hairdresser Colette Arum set out on a simple journey, a 20-minute walk to her boyfriend's house. But when she failed to appear, Colette's boyfriend was instantly concerned and raised the alarm.
I said to my husband, there's something wrong. Colette hasn't arrived at the boyfriend's house and he can't see her anywhere in the village. And I said, we need to phone the police.
Jackie telephoned the police to report her daughter missing.
Please, please.
I didn't feel awkward, I didn't feel embarrassed or anything. I just said, she's missing, she hasn't arrived at where she was supposed to be. And they just said, how can you say a 16-year-old girl is missing at 8 o'clock at night? And I said, easy, when it's my daughter, because she's so predictable. Well, they asked me, actually, what time does she normally come home? And I said, she's never home any later than 9:30. And they said, OK, well, if she hasn't arrived home by 10:30, phone us back again.
Jackie and her husband, Tony, were determined to find their daughter and immediately formulated a plan.
I said to Tony, you know, we can't leave it that length of time. You have to go and drive round and see if you can see her.
Meanwhile, Jackie started to phone anyone who might have seen her daughter.
I rang my aunt and I rang my friend who lived en route, and I believe I rang a couple of her friends. It was like everything was a blur because I was in such a panic.
But no one had seen or heard from Colette. Jackie then joined the search.
It got to 9:30 and she still wasn't home. And I said to Tony, I can't stand this any longer. I am not waiting till 10:30 to phone the police again. I have to phone them now.
When the police arrived, Jackie led them to retrace the route Colette should have taken.
The concern kicked in very, very quickly because it was at that time we didn't know what had happened. We didn't even know if anything had happened.
There was no signs of there having been an accident or a struggle. There was nothing, no clues, nothing. It was like she'd disappeared into thin air.
As they reached the early hours, the police officers were forced to suspend the search. But Jackie's night was far from over.
The police said they'd come the following morning, but we never went to bed that night. We sat up all night, and periodically I'd start to panic and say, you know, what can we do to find her? So I phoned every hospital that I could imagine, and no one had had an accident reported or a girl brought in from a car accident. So I knew that something was far, far more sinister.
Early the next morning, a local man began his drive to work.
A businessman who was just going to a local farm saw what he thought was something suspicious in one of the fields as he went along.
The man turned his car around and drove back down the lane to investigate.
He wasn't sure what he'd seen, but he suspected he'd seen a body in the field.
The man stopped his car.
He saw what appeared to be a naked girl laying in the field. Quite clearly, she was dead.
The businessman did not know the girl, but her name would haunt him forever. He had just discovered the lifeless body of 16-year-old hairdresser Colette Aaron.
There was blood at the scene. I believe it was coming from a head wound. It was clear that she had suffered a sexual assault. Overall, it was not a pleasant sight.
Colette had been found just off Thirlby Lane, less than 2 miles from her home. Whilst the detectives were securing the crime scene, Colette's brother and grandfather arrived.
Mark and my stepfather got to Thirlby Lane as the police had actually just putting the cordon up.
Instinctively, Mark jumped out of the car and raced over to the crime scene.
The police tried to stop them from going into the field, but not before Mark was able to get in far enough to actually see Colette lying in the hedge bottom and see the way she was lying there. What Mark saw has changed his life forever. It's had a big, big impact on his life. He still can't talk about Colette easily these days.
Mark and his grandfather returned home, faced with the horrifying prospect of having to break the news of Colette's death to Jackie and the rest of her family.
As Mark got out of the car, I saw this officer shake his head to the officer at the bottom of the drive. And I knew, as soon as I saw him do that, I knew that she was dead, that my worst fears were true. And I just remember all these screams, really loud screams, my screams.
Whilst the family tried to accept the shocking news of Colette's murder, detectives set up an incident room in a nearby sports pavilion.
I was a young detective at that time, and like many other detectives, I was stationed in the incident room at Keyworth, which is where all the information pertinent to that inquiry was filtered through.
Within hours, the police officers made an intriguing discovery.
Police officers came across a car which they believe they recognise as one that had been reported stolen the previous day.
Detectives were soon able to confirm the car, a red Ford Fiesta, was the vehicle that had been reported missing.
Obviously, alarm bells start to ring because we've had two strange incidents that happened. Colette being missing, stolen car found in the vicinity. We'd be failing our duty if we hadn't given a lot of thought to that car, even at the very early stage.
The car was stolen 5 miles away from Keyworth in an area called Home Pierpont.
Earlier on in that day, at about 4:30, a lady had gone to tend to her horses and she'd parked up her red Fiesta motor car, left the keys into it, and as she'd gone away from the vehicle was stolen, and she thought it was an opportunist who drove it away.
As the detectives learnt more about the theft, they became convinced the car was connected to Colette's murder.
At the scene where Colette was found, there were tyre tracks in and out of the field, and there was no mud on Colette's soles of her feet that would indicate that she'd probably been attacked in the vehicle that was suspected to have been involved in this offence and sadly deposited in the field and the offender driven away.
The detectives painstakingly examined the car for any signs of a struggle and discovered both blood and semen stains. Within hours of the media reporting Colette's murder, police officers were inundated with information from potential witnesses.
Information came to the police attention that as she walked to her boyfriend's house, she saw a couple of groups of people, had brief conversations with them,
As far as the people were concerned, there was no suggestion that Colette was being followed or anything, and she just seemed a normal, cheerful self.
Eyewitness reports revealed that Colette was last seen on the junction of Nicker Lane and Platt Lane, walking towards Willow Brook, as expected. But it was another local witness who provided the police with a chilling piece of information.
The man had been working in his garden. When he heard a scream, he also heard a car skidding. He went to his gate to have a look, but he couldn't see anything. Of course, he thought nothing more about it, but passed that information as soon as he was aware there'd been the incident.
This latest piece of information suggested Colette had been taken just moments after the last sighting. As the investigation progressed, Colette's family struggled to cope with the traumatic circumstances surrounding her brutal murder.
You've got the initial shock of, yeah, you know, all your worst fears have been confirmed. And then you suddenly realise, yeah, you know, this is for real. It's not a dream. She's never going to come home. Knowing that she'd actually been raped and murdered. She was murdered for sex, if you like, for want of a better word. And I find that very, very difficult to come to terms with.
And when Colette's friends heard the news, they were devastated.
My friend Suzanne told me that Colette had been murdered. I didn't quite believe it at the time. And she said Nick's got the paper.
Wendy looked at the evening newspaper and couldn't believe what she read.
It was there in black and white that she'd been found murdered. But I just didn't want to talk. All I did was cry. It was a total, total shock.
As details of the vicious murder continued to spread, not one, but two crucial witnesses came forward.
Two young girls who came forward, who separately had actually seen the man and been disturbed by his behaviour at that time.
The first girl was just walking from house to house in Keyworth during that early evening prior to Colette being abducted, and was definitely followed by the man in the red vest.
She didn't speak to him, and he didn't speak to her, but his behaviour, the way he was looking at her, alarmed her, and she immediately went to a friend's house nearby to get away from him.
At 7:30 p.m, the man approached the second girl, who was 14 years old.
She was exercising a dog, and I actually saw him, and he stopped nearby. When she looked at him, he asked for the direction of a nearby road.
The girl kept on walking, but was surprised when the same car pulled up next to her about 10 minutes later. The man got out of the car and walked towards her. The man seemed surprised by the girl's dog. Suddenly, he turned on his heels and left.
Once the two girls came forward, they were interviewed at great length, and they were able to give us a good description of the man, which was vital to subsequent inquiries.
By questioning the two girls in detail, the detectives were able to build a picture of what Colette's murderer looked like.
The composite description was of a white male about 5'10", stocky build, with wavy hair. Without a shadow of a doubt, those two teenage girls were extremely lucky not to have been abducted and subjected to the assault that Colette was subjected to.
These two new witnesses were very important, but there was more to come. Detectives were about to speak to the investigation's most important eyewitness, whose testimony was to prove vital.
The landlady explained to the detectives that she'd seen this stranger in the pub with what appeared to be blood on his hands.
On the evening of Sunday the 30th of October 1983, 16-year-old Colette Arum disappeared as she walked to her boyfriend's house. Colette's body was discovered the next morning, abandoned in a nearby field. A post-mortem revealed she had endured a serious sexual assault before being strangled. The police appealed for information through newspapers and television, generating a wealth of leads. The information provided by one eyewitness who came forward was to prove crucial.
The landlady from the Generous Britain Public House at Costock told the police that a stranger had visited the pub on Sunday the 30th of October, between about 8:50 and 9:15 p.m.
The man explained he was in the area to visit a friend but had lost his way. Then the landlady noticed something unusual.
During the conversation, she noticed he'd got some blood on his hands, and she commented to him. He appeared generally surprised. He then went through to the gents' toilet, to where he washed it off and used the paper towels that were in there.
Despite her never having served a customer with blood on his hands before, the landlady had no specific reason to be suspicious.
But it's only when she, the following day, that she heard about the murder of Colette and immediately telephoned the police.
Police officers headed straight over to the pub.
They searched through the gents' toilets and they took possession of the paper towels from there, including one where, to their eye, appeared to have blood on it.
Forensic scientists were able to prove the paper towel did have blood on it, but techniques available in 1983 could barely identify what blood type it was, let alone reveal whose body it had come from.
It didn't particularly take the inquiry further because we didn't know whose blood it was at that time.
The investigation continued, but on the 17th of November 1983, the detectives were surprised to receive a very peculiar letter.
The letter was written with a straight edge, obviously, to disguise the handwriting, and an exclamation mark had been put in place instead of the S. Why is still not known to this day.
The letter goaded the detectives over their inability to catch him.
There was certain information in there that was not in the public domain, hence the detectives at the time believed the letter was genuine and that the perpetrator had actually written the letter.
The author of the letter betrayed his identity with a foolish mistake. Forensic experts found a fingerprint just above the line, "You will never get me."
It's significant that fingerprints were left on the letter, but I think it was an accidental mark. The letter was examined and checked on the databases that existed in those days, but sadly, no hits.
The days turned to weeks, the weeks turned to months. Hard work was continued. We were running a full incident room and taking a lot of manpower because it was felt that it was an important case, one that we needed to throw whatever resource we'd got at it.
But despite the evidence found in the early stages of the inquiry, detectives were unable to identify Colette Arum's killer. And as time passed, newer crimes began to demand their attention.
We didn't actually close it down altogether at that time, but it was reduced after about 12 months to 18 months because we were getting nothing new on this particular inquiry to justify us carrying on.
There were no more leads.
They never actually knocked on the door and said, you know, we have to shelve this, we can't continue with the investigation. I just thought that they weren't doing anything about it anymore.
Colette's mother was devastated.
I'm thinking, well, you know, he's got away with this and he was out there living his life wherever he was and it wasn't bothering him and he didn't have any form of conscience, really. You know, all these things go through your mind and eventually this was one of the reasons I went to live abroad.
But in the late 1980s, detective work was revolutionised by the introduction of DNA profiling. Each one of us has a unique DNA profile. The police began to use forensic science to identify perpetrators of crimes by analysing any bodily fluids, skin or hair left at the scene of a crime.
If you could prepare a DNA profile from something deposited by the offender, you could then challenge the National DNA database and potentially identify somebody.
And in 1997, Dr. Tim Clayton was given the task of using DNA analysis to identify Colette Arum's elusive killer.
My remit was to try and prepare a DNA profile from anything that may relate to the offender for which we could then search against the national database. And I was fairly optimistic that we would be able to at least attempt DNA profiling. We still had some of Colette's clothing and some various other items like the car mats and various swabbings taken from the vehicle. There were also some of the post-mortem samples available as well.
But there was a risk. Dr. Clayton was well aware that his investigations could have repercussions.
You've got a limited amount of material available, and the question is, do you commit it to testing now and effectively consume it and destroy it, or do you leave it and think there may be future developments which will give me better tests and better opportunities? And that was the dilemma that I faced in 1997.
Dr. Clayton decided to do everything he could to identify the DNA profile of the killer.
It's no good having it all in the freezer if it remains undetected. I'd rather do it and fail than not advance a case.
Using samples taken from the post-mortem, the scientist was able to identify Colette's DNA profile. But unfortunately, he had less success when trying to identify the profile of her killer.
Most of the exhibits that we tested, a lot of recovered hairs and things, just failed to yield a profile because there was simply insufficient DNA present.
Dr. Clayton hoped to have more luck with a set of sealed microscope slides containing semen samples recovered during the post-mortem.
Those microscope slides had been kept, so I'd got there a little time capsule, a little sample of sperm from Colette's body, which had been sealed, and so they were obviously a target for us.
The forensic scientist got to work.
As it turned out, we didn't get the result we wanted. We got a partial result, not a full result.
A full DNA profile features 20 markers, 10 that come directly from each parent. Dr. Clayton had found just 3.
In the event, it didn't help progress the inquiry much other than provide the partial profile and maybe eliminate some persons of interest from the investigation.
Even the paper towel recovered from the Generous Britain pub failed to produce any fresh clues.
In 1997, the main object was to try and identify a potential offender. I'd failed in that regard, and eventually the 97 review was wound down.
But the murder of Colette Aram would continue to haunt the residents of Nottingham. And Nottinghamshire police remained resolute in their determination to catch the 16-year-old's killer.
When this crime happened, it rocked Nottinghamshire, and Keyworth itself has never been the same since.
In 2004, the case was to get a new lease of life when Detective Superintendent Kevin Flint was appointed head of Nottinghamshire Police's homicide unit.
Every person that's been involved in this investigation has wanted to bring it to a close. So I was as determined as anyone else that had worked on it to try and bring it to a successful conclusion.
Believing that new advances in DNA analysis could help identify Colette's killer, Detective Superintendent Flint launched a fresh investigation into her murder.
We ran the investigation as though it was a murder that had occurred today with a dedicated inquiry team. This case was so big and there was so much information that had been gleaned. If that answer was there to be found, we'd find it.
Over the next 2 years, the team painstakingly analysed every last detail of the case.
There was in excess of 2,500 statements, 5,000 documents, up to nearly 700 exhibits. Everything was placed on the home's computerised system so that we could examine and identify any new leads in the inquiry.
Dr. Tim Clayton was also employed to re-examine all forensic evidence pertinent to the investigation.
I have to say I was quite pessimistic because in 1997 I'd thought I'd used everything that was left. We gradually built up a picture of what exhibits were left and came up with a batting plan of what to test. Now, one of the key exhibits was the paper towel, although I was still sceptical whether it was even linked to this particular matter.
Using improved DNA analysis methods developed during the 24 years since the police had first found the paper towel, the scientist was able to search for traces of blood and semen.
We picked up mixtures of DNA, effectively people's DNA profiles superimposed on each other. And when I looked at these, most of these mixtures appeared to be just two people, one male, one female.
Intrigued, Dr. Clayton compared the sample to the one full DNA profile he had recovered in 1997, that of Colette Aaron.
It matched, and here we are, potential link between Colette and a paper towel found in a pub toilet miles and miles away, and suddenly the landlady's story took on a better and higher significance because now we've potentially got a positive link between Colette and this paper towel.
Suddenly, Dr. Clayton realised he was finally on the brink of discovering the full DNA profile of Colette Aram's murderer.
It was possible to subtract Colette's profile from these mixtures. I was able to work out his DNA profile unambiguously, exactly.
In order to be sure all the evidence was pointing to the same man, the scientist ran the results against the partial profile identified back in 1997.
The partial DNA profile obtained from the microscope slide in 1997 was a match against this male.
24 years after the murder, Dr. Clayton had finally identified the full DNA profile of Colette's killer.
It was another significant boost and lift to the inquiry, and we knew that we were on the right lines.
Dr. Clayton immediately hoped he would find the killer's DNA profile already on the national database. He ran the search.
We got told almost immediately that there were no matches on the national DNA database. In the space of probably a few hours, we'd gone from being elated to being quite disappointed. I had a piece of paper in front of me, the DNA profile of Colette's killer, but it told me nothing about him. Without somebody to compare that to, it's effectively a useless piece of information.
Right, people.
The team were also disappointed by the news and wondered how someone who had committed such a horrendous crime could be absent from all police databases.
Throughout the investigation, the consideration was that the person could be dead, and obviously that brings with it the feeling that that person's got away with it, both from a police perspective and Colette's family. So it was still important to eliminate them or identify the person if he was dead.
Back in the lab, Dr. Tim Clayton was keen to utilise another form of DNA analysis known as familial searching.
First-degree relatives, that's parents or children or siblings along the same generation, have much more similar DNA profiles than do unrelated people.
By searching the DNA database for profiles with high similarities to the killer, it might be possible to identify one of his close relatives.
The search for the parent-child list yielded several thousand people, and the sibling list, again, gave several thousand people. So, although you've reduced the pool, no longer are we looking for now a needle in a haystack, we're now looking for a needle in a hay bale.
The scientist identified three groups of 100 people who had the closest DNA match to the killer. The first group were the parent-child matches. The next 100 were the sibling matches. And the final list featured persons of interest already named within the inquiry.
There weren't the resources to go down those lists further than that. It took nearly 18 months of work to screen out 300 people.
In 2008, as the 25th anniversary of Colette's brutal murder approached, Detective Superintendent Flint launched a fresh appeal for information.
We published a leaflet and delivered it to up to 20,000 homes in and around Nottinghamshire.
It was the first time that we'd publicised the fact we'd got a full profile, and we wanted it to be known that we were able to identify the killer.
The campaign generated hundreds of new leads.
There were lots of positive enquiries and lots of good information and lots of good potential persons of interest.
Despite a positive response, the detectives were still unable to identify Colette's killer.
We thought that the 25-year push would give us something. With the number of calls that we investigated, we were obviously very disappointed. You think, where do we go next with this? Is there any more the key line of inquiry remained with the familial DNA.
However, in spring 2009, 18 months after first running a familial search of the killer's DNA, the team concluded their investigations of the 300 people identified.
As it turned out, none of the people on the prioritised lists had the same profile, and effectively all the top 300 people had all been eliminated.
The reinvestigation into Colette's murder was starting to look as if it had hit another brick wall.
Mr. Flint said, "I think we're at the end now. We've given this a really good go. Is there anything else we can do now before we put this to bed and say we've tried and we failed?" And I just came up with one idea. I just said, well, it was nearly 18 months, 2 years ago since we did the familial search. Maybe that we should just redo it and just see if in the intervening period whether anybody has been added to the national database.
Detective Superintendent Flint gave the go-ahead and the forensic scientist ran the search.
To my amazement, on the top of the list came a person who had the highest ranked genetic likelihood ratio. And more intriguingly than that, that person lived very close to the Keyworth area.
The database had identified a man who had been arrested in early 2008 for a minor offence. Had detectives finally found 16-year-old Colette Arum's killer? Years after Colette Arum's blood-soaked body was found on farmland in Nottinghamshire, detectives were finally close to identifying her killer. Using familial DNA analysis, forensic scientist Tim Clayton had identified a 20-year-old man who shared a number of DNA markers identical to Colette's killer. But there was a major problem. He wasn't born until after Colette was killed.
We researched that individual who was actually on the DNA database, and quite clearly that was not the offender. It was too young and was not a positive match.
But the results suggested that either this man's father or possibly an uncle had raped and murdered Colette back in 1983.
Those inquiries led us to be interested in four brothers that emanated from South Nottinghamshire.
You can see the similarities.
Any of those individuals could have been the offender.
The detectives started to investigate the lives of the four brothers and were surprised to discover they had been raised in the home Pierpont area.
We found out that the family home overlooked the site where the car was stolen from near the riding stables.
The family also had connections to Keyworth. We felt we were into the right family to find the offender.
Specifically, the detectives discovered that one of the men actually lived in Keyworth at the time of Colette's murder. His name was Paul Hutchinson.
Hutchinson married and moved to Keyworth with his wife in 1983.
It was quite surprising to find that he was, say, a few streets away from Colette's address. There's no suggestion that he knew Colette or actually knew the family.
As the detectives continued to explore the lives of all four brothers, they became aware of a complication.
We found out that one of the siblings had died recently. So that was a blow initially to think how we're going to eliminate this person.
Despite the circumstantial evidence pointing to Paul Hutchinson and the revelation that one of the brothers had passed away, the detectives couldn't rule anyone out.
We couldn't rate one higher than the other. Hence, we took the decision that all three surviving brothers would be arrested, and the only way to effectively eliminate was to obtain each individual's DNA.
On the morning of Monday, April the 7th, 2009, police officers carried out simultaneous raids on three properties in the Nottingham area and arrested three men on suspicion of murder.
Two out of the three brothers were cooperative and helpful and assisted the police. The other brother was uncooperative, and the officers felt that he was quite worried upon arrest.
Each of the men was taken into custody, where DNA samples and fingerprints were collected before being sent for immediate analysis. In the interviews that followed, one of the brothers, Paul Hutchinson, continued to be evasive.
One of the brothers had reserved his right to remain silent and effectively went no comment through all the interviews that were put to him.
With events developing rapidly, Detective Superintendent Flint telephoned Colette's mother, Jackie.
He said, "Where are you?" And I said, "I've just come in from shopping." And I said, "Why? Have you got something to tell me? Have you got some news for me?" And he said, "Well, we've got three brothers in custody, and we know that it's going to have to be one of them." And I just broke down. And then, of course, he said, "Well, you know, we'll let you know more when we know more." And then he said, "You know, I'll phone you in a couple of days."
As the suspects were interrogated, the forensic team closely examined the three brothers' DNA and fingerprints. Eventually, they were able to tell the detectives what they'd found.
One of the brothers' fingerprints was on the letter. And it was absolutely fantastic news, because there was always a question mark over whether the author of the letter was the killer, and this just confirmed it, and it was the icing on the cake.
And soon afterwards, the results of the DNA analysis were also confirmed.
I think around the 10 o'clock time at night on the initial day of arrest, I received a telephone call giving us the news that we got a positive match.
It was fantastic news, and it was what we'd been waiting for all these years, and it was the moment of truth, really. We'd found our man.
On Wednesday, the 9th of April 2009, 25 years after her death, the detectives were finally able to charge a suspect with the murder of Colette Arum. His name was Paul Hutchinson, and he claimed he was not guilty.
I think it was a mixed emotions, really, that I felt when he was charged. Relief, disbelief, all the emotions that I felt in the beginning raised their ugly head again.
As detectives started to collate evidence in preparation for the trial, it seemed that after Colette's murder, Hutchinson tried to live an almost normal life.
He'd remained local, living in Keyworth, and would appear to have been a likeable person to his immediate close family and close friends.
When the police team interviewed Paul Hutchinson's relatives, they were told Hutchinson's life hadn't been easy, because he had fought intermittent battles with cancer. But detectives investigated all his medical records and found this was completely untrue.
He lied to his family about this, and even went to the extent of removing some of his hair and disappearing for a little while, pretending to be in hospital.
Even back in 1983, during door-to-door inquiries immediately following the murder, Hutchinson claimed to have been in hospital receiving treatment.
His family were obviously unaware in relation to the fabrication about the cancer.
This man was an inveterate liar, made a career out of telling lies, particularly with his close members of his family.
Paul Hutchinson's murder trial was due to take place in spring 2010. But as the date approached, Hutchinson suddenly became cooperative.
Ultimately, we received the defence statement where Paul Hutchinson blamed his dead brother for committing this atrocious offence.
The tale he told was that his brother committed the offence and told him about it thereafter.
But unbeknown to Hutchinson, the detectives had already acquired a sample of his late brother's blood from the hospital in which he had been treated before he died.
We managed to obtain that individual's DNA, and with the cooperation of the deceased brother's family, we were able to eliminate him from the inquiry.
With his accusation of his dead brother discredited, the suspect had a sudden change of heart.
Thankfully, when he looked at the weight of evidence against him, he decided to change his plea to guilty and ultimately pleaded guilty to the murder of Colette.
In January 2010, Paul Hutchinson was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of 16-year-old Colette Arum. finally, Nottinghamshire Police have been able to close one of their biggest cases.
The efforts of people some 25 years ago, supported by the efforts of recent times, have culminated in this man being found guilty. Had the original inquiry had the advancement of forensic technology that we had, hopefully that this case would have been detected in 1983 or 1984.
Despite the many years which have passed, Colette's murder continues to affect everyone involved.
To this day, Paul Hutchinson has not explained why he's done what he's done. And that will be really difficult for the family to understand. I don't think we'll ever get an explanation from him.
And for Colette's family, her loss overrides any sense of justice.
I miss her smile. I miss her laughter. I just miss her. I just miss her very much. It's all those years ago, but it's like it was yesterday, and I just wish she was here with us now. And I think if she was here now, my life would be different too. But she's not, and she never will be.